Hello everyone and welcome to the Maccast. We had so much fun messing around with everybody by having a full team of Macs on a little bit ago. We thought we'd do it again. So this week we have Game Dev Matt. Hello.
Hi there.
We have Matt from New Zealand.
Hello.
And we have Honorary Matt.
Hi, it's me, Matt Janney.
So, good to have you all on. We're going to have a bit of music to kick things off, and then we'll start talking about games that feature mats. Welcome back. That was our customary Hatsune Miku track to get things going. Remote Control, great song. We've thrown it in there this week because if you're keen on going to a Hatsune Miku concert, you're probably going to hear that one. It seems to be a regular part of the playlist. And if you are keen on going along, the September Miku concert in Japan, the really big one that everybody who's a real fan has to go to, the lottery for the tickets has opened up. So you need to head along to the concert website and put your name down. And then you'll find out in about a month if you've been one of the lucky ones that gets to buy a ticket. So yeah, go and do it. It's well worth it. I highly recommend actually organizing a trip to Japan just to experience that thing because it's cool. Well, it's not really cool. It's Miku, but it's awesome. I don't think it can be called cool. I mean, it's not like it's motorbike riding or something like that, but it's fun, you know? It's great.
You can tweet me photos live from the show and make me slowly weep.
I'll live broadcast it, even though you're not meant to do that. And I'll get in all kinds of trouble. And there's so much data on my phone via roaming that I have a massive deal. But I'll be popular with the Miku fans around the world for about 10 minutes. Okay, so to kick things off this week, we thought we'd talk about Persona 5 again because we can't stop talking about Persona 5, and there's always seems to be things that keep cropping up to talk about with regards to Persona 5. There's been more controversy over the past week because the more people that are playing it, the more people are starting to realize that the translation or localization, whatever you want to call it, isn't perfect, and people are getting very upset about that, and everybody seems to have opinions about localization because everybody seems to think that they're experts in Japan to English. English translation. Of course they're not, and a lot of stuff that's been out there has been pretty silly, but you know, there's also legitimate complaints about the way that the localization has been managed with Persona 5. So basically, on a very basic level, there are some issues with grammar and English phrasing and so on, which you know you can't really defend, the localization house that did Persona 5 should probably feel pretty bad about that stuff. But at the same time, there are a lot of complaints about, you know, changes that have been made from the script in taking it from Japanese to English. And a lot of people don't seem to realize that when it comes to localization, you actually do need to make changes to the script in order to localize not just the words, because that's the kind of the surface level of localization. But localization also involves translating meaning and culture and making sure that the culture that you're translating it into can understand the basic themes and ideas that the story is sharing around. And Persona 5 being the very complex kind of narrative that it is a particularly difficult one to localize. So I guess my overall thoughts about all of this is that Persona 5 is probably a little bit hard done by the people complaining about translation. It's not a perfect translation, but by the same token, I think people have an idea about what localization involves that's a little bit inaccurate. And if anybody ever tries to read Shakespeare in Japanese, for example, you'd realize that you know, certain liberties have to be taken in order to actually take something from one language and you know, make it relevant to another. So that's me. I know Matt has very strong opinions about Persona 5. Well, we're all Matts, but Matt from New Zealand has very strong opinions about Persona 5's localization. So I'll let him rant on about how I'm wrong for a bit.
I don't know how wrong I think you are. I haven't seen any complaints about people saying that complaining about how stuff has been changed. And I think that is really my main concern that I've found, and what a lot of other people, or at least other professional Japanese to English translators, are criticizing it for, is that it hasn't had that kind of localization effort in terms of translating ideas rather than just words. And that's what I found, is you have a lot of things where the meaning is lost because it's just been translated directly and into English that doesn't really, sometimes doesn't make sense at all. And often you can vaguely understand what's being said, but it's lost the tone and the character. So I think that's really my big issue with that is,
Do you think that might be because Atlas was a little bit worried about people getting upset about it not being a literal translation? Because that seems to be where the internet tends to blow up or at people who do localizations, is when they try to do a proper translation as opposed to a literal one. Like, to give you the great example, I mean, the one that comes off the top of my head for Atlas in particular, the Tokyo Mirage Sessions Fire Emblem game on the Wii U got a lot of criticism for the way it was localized. And there was one particular scene, for example, where one of the dungeons in the game was changed fairly comprehensively. In Japan, the dungeon was kind of modeled after gravure models, which are basically bikini models. But they're a very Japanese approach to bikini models, and there's certain cultural implications and assumptions that are made about that part of the fashion industry that doesn't translate into the West very well. So when it came to doing the Western version of that dungeon, they changed it into a fashion model dungeon. So there was this big controversy about censorship because suddenly the girls were wearing more clothes and stuff. But I don't think that was the case. I think the reason they did that was because they took what Gravio models mean in Japan and got the best approximation they could for the Western release of that. And I think the controversy that was quite extreme for that game may have made Atlus a little bit tentative about making proper localization changes to Persona 5.
I don't know. I think it's something that, obviously, Tokyo Mirage Sessions that has a lot of that, but it's not something that Atlus has ever really been too concerned about before. And, I mean, the things that in Persona 5 probably needed to be localized more are not controversial things like that. I mean, it's talking about, you know, giving Morgana a or every character who isn't Ryuji, really, giving them, you know, some sort of personality that comes through in the dialogue, where in the Japanese scripts, they have a lot of that kind of personality. But in the English scripts, it's just everyone kind of just talks the same, and they're fairly, it's almost like each character's lines are interchangeable as far as who's actually saying them. And there's not really any of that consistency. And I think that's the, aside from, you know, the basic kind of technical grammatical stuff, that's the thing that I find really frustrating.
Really? Because, I mean, for me, I didn't think that the characters were... I had a pretty good sense that each character was different, personally. Like,
I think... Luckily for the game, there's a lot of that character comes through in other ways as well, like the visual design and the voice acting. But in terms of the actual script, I mean, you've got... I think Morgana's the particularly grating example where, like, sometimes he's this kind of weird little dorky mascot, and at other times he's basically... could almost be Ryuji from, the way that he talks. And there's just... I think, there's a lot of that consistency, I think, that is lacking. I think it probably comes down more than anything to deadlines and publishing and wanting to actually get their thing out, because it's been was already a couple of times for localization, and I think what it really needed is just more time, and Atlus for business reasons was not able to give it that. And so I think instead of having one or two translators and editors taking the time to do a good job, they threw six translators and eight editors at it, and so then you're always going to get a bit of different voices from different writers.
Yeah, I think that I read somewhere that they did say that Persona 5 had had the biggest team of people on any Persona game for this localization. So that probably contributed to the various voices, I suppose, that would come through in terms of the translation.
Yeah, and I mean that's a good point. I mean, if you look at when, you know, you translate literature or whatever, it's not. I mean, for example, you know, Arabian Nights is a good example. Yeah, that's a classic book in Arabic, and bringing it into English, there's, you know, three or four really good translations out there, and each one reads significantly different because, you know, it's there's a lot of creativity that goes into translation. And the voice of the author does come through, and that's inevitable, and that's an important part of translation. So if you've got a big team working on it, then you are going to get, you know, a mix of voices come through as well.
I think really the biggest problem is that it's just Atlus has set such a good standard for localization, especially with Persona 4, which I don't think there's anyone who would say anything bad about the way that was localized, and especially because it came out almost 10 years ago when standards weren't quite so as high as they are now anyway. And so, and I think every Atlus game I've played since that has been of a similar quality. So there is that kind of expectation with Persona 5 to be on that same level. And it just, I mean, it's not, it's, I don't think it's as bad as what a lot of people are saying, and it doesn't, it is mildly distracting. It doesn't ruin the whole game, which is in every other way is a really good game. But I think it's just, there is an expectation on Atlas and on Persona to be a lot better than what it actually is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like you can't tell that, you know, Anne's better than Makoto from playing the game. I mean, that's... Yeah, it's not that bad a localization where those kind of characters are interchangeable. I think that there's, you know, internet being the internet and Twitter anime avatars being Twitter anime avatars as they are, they're kind of over-exaggerating things to a ridiculous extreme because they just have nothing better to do with their lives. But, yeah, I agree that it's not the perfect translation. And I think the other factor is, of course, that Yakuza 0 came out just a couple of months ago, and Yakuza 0 deserves awards for its localization effort. I think there isn't a better game out there that's, you know, ever. I would actually say that Yakuza 0 is probably the best translation of a game that I've ever come across. So for Sega / Atlas to go from there to Persona 5, that's again, coming off a very high plateau to, you know, jump down a couple of tiers. So, yeah.
It's amazing how much personality came with Yakuza 0, like, from day one of it, sort of making its way into the West. Like, they were very on top of that. No, I just wanted to say, like, you know, I mean, this is now the second podcast I've been on talking about Persona 5, having not actually played it. So, you know, take it.
What are you waiting for?
Oh, I know, right? Like, it's on the list. It's no, I've been drooling at it for a long time, but I just have to make it happen. But no, like, I had a look at, like, some of the dialogue examples that you know, were pulled out as you know, like, subpar or you know, clunky or whatever, and it's like, you know, they're certainly not the greatest, you know, most nuanced pieces of dialogue ever, but, you know, I don't think they're any more, you know, there's any more sin there than, you know, there has been all through, you know, anime being brought into the West. Like, I remember watching, like, Evangelion back in the day, and there was just sort of, like, so many of those kind of awkward translated moments that kind of got saved by the character acting in a lot of ways. I don't think they were particularly awful by any means.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, even Studio Ghibli has its moments where you, depending how familiar you are with Japanese, of course, but you'd look at some of the ways that it's the dialogue's been translated, and you just wonder if that's the best way that you could reflect that line in English. It's a creative process. Localization is a creative process. It can add and it can detract from the original work because it is that extra layer of creative ideas, and it's not like writing something from scratch, but it's not like a scientific work either, where there's only one answer. There, you give any line in any language and try and translate into another language, and you're going to have to put some subjective opinion or subjective sense of your own creativity over the top. It's just inevitable. So,
yeah, and I mean, I think it's interesting that you bring up, because localization has always had those kind of issues that you're talking about, Matt. But I think things have come a long way, especially sort of in the last 10 years, and Atlas has been at the forefront of it. And playing Persona 5, it kind of feels, in terms of the translation, it feels like playing something from the early 2000s. And I mean, I guess there's a certain charm in that, but I think...
Yeah,
I don't know. I think I
get it from it. Sorry, go on.
And obviously a lot of other people do as well.
I don't think it's that bad.
Not Final Fantasy X, Matt.
Yeah, I mean, and not only that, but I mean, if we're thinking about games that have been ridiculously awful when it comes to localization, I distinctly remember Fire Emblem Fates being, like, ridiculously horrific. when it came to localization. Like, we're talking like entire bits of dialogue being cut out, not even for any particular reason, like not because there would have been a culture clash or a value clash, you know. And then, I mean, the skin ship feature, which is, if you guys are familiar with the Fire Emblem Fates controversy, speak now, I want to describe it. Basically, you could kind of, when you bonded with your love interest, you could kind of, you could touch them with the 3DS stylus in the Japanese version. And so you could like gently pat your love interest, and that would bring them closer to you in some way.
That's how it works in real life,
it's a feature,
right?
That all games need, I have to say.
Yeah,
that.
Like, you know, you would like gently pat your love interest and your teammates, even though you don't have to be alone. You could just gently pat everyone and then improve their bonds with you. You know, mostly, you know, pretty harmless stuff considering the animation of it. It's not like you're out here grabbing you're not grabbing a handful of anything, you know, you're just kind of gently patting everyone. And the localization removed that completely from the English version, removed a bunch of dialogue between characters that would, and then had later support conversations continue on the basis that the conversation that wasn't shown in the English version had actually happened, and just things like that. And it's just, I mean, after that, which left like a horrible taste in my mouth, I barely noticed the errors with Persona 5. I mean, like, they were there, but I never at all felt like they detracted from the game at all, just because, you know, of the dumpster fire of a train wreck that was a localization of Fire Emblem Fates. So, I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, it's much the same. I've got another example. Bravely Default, back on the 3DS, the first one, had a really jarring translation issue, like you mentioned, where one of the characters, Edea, had this scene where she would she wore this swimsuit as a way of distracting a guard, I think. She had a reason to wear a particularly daring swimsuit. Mm. Anyway, and Ringabel, another one of the characters, was going on and on and on about how daring it is and so on, because he was a bit of a pervert. And, you know, that was Ringabel's character. But then Edea comes out and you see her on screen and she's wearing something, in the English version, I mean, she's wearing something, you know, really conservative by swimsuit standards. And, yeah, that kind of jarring thing is really... that's bad translation, localization. If you're going to change a costume or whatever and a character's referring to the costume, you need to change what the character's actually referring to as well. Otherwise, you know, you've got that jarring effect and people go, what the hell's going on here? And I think Persona 5, any changes it made, it did in a context, I think it's not that kind of sinfully bad localization. And I think people need to keep that in mind when talking about that game and its localization. And welcome back. So, continuing the chat about narratives and storytelling in games, we thought we'd have a talk about visual novels as well this week. I've been playing Hakuoki Kyoto Winds, which is the new subtitle and the new version of Compile Heart. I think it might be Idea Factory. It's one of the Idea Factory companies anyway. It's probably their best known visual novel. It's been around for many years now in various versions. I've played it before on PlayStation 3 and on iPad. And this is kind of an enhanced version, has additional characters to talk to and so on. I've been getting right back into the whole visual novel thing thanks to that game, because it is probably my favorite visual novel. For those people who haven't played it before, it's basically Otome dating game where you play as a woman and there's a whole bunch of really cute guys and you get to pick one and then build a relationship with him and then eventually have the whole romance thing. So it's like Persona 5 but in reverse, really. And it's based in a particularly interesting period of Japanese history. The Shinsengumi are the main kind of group of people that you're interacting with. They were a kind of military police force back a couple of centuries ago now. And they were controversial. They kind of acted like assassins and secret service people at times for a pretty corrupt government. And this game does an interesting job of romanticizing them and giving you a interesting look, I guess, at characters that probably were nothing like that game version. But they're all very cute men. And yeah, it's really well written. Really, really well written. It's the localization is spot on as well. So yeah, if you haven't had a chance to play Hakuoki in some version before, this one's on the PlayStation Vita. But like I said, you can get it on iPad and so on. And I really, really recommend giving it a go. So let's talk about other vision novels. Ginny,
Before we go on to other vision novels, who do you recommend people date in Hakuoki?
Oh, you've got to pick the one that kind of suits your soul, Matt.
One that speaks to your heart.
They all speak to my heart, though.
They're all very different, but they are all like seriously pretty guys. If you've never played an Otome game before, they're really interesting. I mean, obviously, they're primarily targeted at the women market in Japan. But, yeah, they've got such a beautiful art style, typically, and they're so well written because they're less focused on, I guess, action and drama, kind of action drama, as kind of the male-orientated visual novels tend to be. So they've got a very different style of storytelling. They're quite lyrical. They're quite beautiful. They're quite elegant. And yeah, this one is really worth playing. And then, play it a couple of times. Date all the men. It's good fun. So, talking about other visual novels, Ginny, do you have a particular favorite visual novel off the top of your head?
Visual novel? Ooh. Okay. I actually quite like Nekopara. You know, that game where you open a bakery with your family's two cat girls that come and help you? No?
No, I don't know that one, but Cat Girl, that got me interested.
I've never played it, but I'm familiar with it, and it's one of the ones I've been meaning to play for a long time.
Yep, it's got chocolate, really it's got chocolate and vanilla and their sisters, and from the beginning. It is a visual novel where you move away from home to open your own bakery, and while you're unpacking in your empty premises, you discover that your family's cat girls have stowed away with you, and then they can't bear to be parted from you, and they really want to live with you, and so you go, yeah, okay, let's just all run a bakery together, and then you can run your bakery with your cat girls, and also get to know them a lot better. it is described, I think Steam called it an adult visual novel. So, there is some content there which is sexual. But I think it's overall a very light-hearted story. If you can obviously buy a censored version, where there's nothing explicit in it. And I think I've played both versions, and I think the censored one isn't any less fun. I think this point that you brought up, Matt from Australia, well, Matt Sainsbury from Australia. I was going to say, it's two Matts from Australia. I think because visual novels don't have the option of creating action and drama through interaction per se, or through participation. Like, I don't mean just like, you know, clicking on stuff and like kind of reading the story. I mean, like, when you play most games, obviously you're doing active things to facilitate the story in that way. Like whether it's like stabbing something in the ass, or, you know, making a choice to romance someone, or like shooting up someone else to do, like, you're doing something active and participatory. I think because visual novels don't have that, they really, really rely on characterization. Even though Nekopara is not an otome game, or not like a romance game per se, because in the sense of one, you know, you don't get to do that at all, basically, it's actually quite charming still. And I think that visual novels are much closer to books, in my opinion, than games, even though we interact with them in like a digital format and they have flashy pictures and moving elements. I think that a good visual novel is a visual novel that tells a story like it's a book, as opposed to a VN game, if that makes sense.
So, I agree with you. That debate about whether visual novels are games or not is a bit nonsense, and it doesn't really matter anyway. It's something you play with the debate about what's a game or not is just a pointless one, as far as I'm concerned. But I do agree that kind of visual novels have more in relation to novels, just by the way that they're designed. And you kind of judge a visual novel by the same criteria as well. It's not so much as it's fun to press buttons, but it's the quality of the storytelling, it's the quality of the characters, it's how much you get along with the narrative and so on. So Matt from Australia, not me, other Matt from Australia, I'm not sure if you're a huge fan of visual novels, but if you were to play one, would you prefer something that's kind of very narrative focused with maybe one or two decisions to make through the game? Or would you prefer a visual novel that's a bit like, kind of Danganronpa, which has, some gamey elements in there to go with the storytelling? I mean, what's the right balance for you?
I've played a handful, they're certainly not the all-consuming passion or anything, but I've played a few from a few different places, and the place I got to it with it was, I don't need a lot of interaction, but I need just a touch somewhere in there. Things that are just 100% click forward end to end, that kind of especially if I, if I'm not finding the narrative like super engaging straight out the gate, I need something, some sort of little interactive moment early on. It's sort of something I find quite that I really enjoy though is all this stuff that's come from visual novels that's showing up in other games now. I find that really fascinating. Ways of really effectively communicating character emotions with very little animation, or just through simple facial expression changes without it having to divulge into some sort of AAA highly animated thing. That part of it is hugely exciting to me.
Matt, your game, Mole Men Must Die, that's basically a visual novel, isn't it?
Well, it is. If you keep on going long enough, there is several romance options down the back end of the game.
Can you romance the King of the Moles?
Yes. Well, that is actually how you achieve ultimate peace for the world.
That's good. Lessons for things. But I guess on a more serious note, would you have had any of that kind of inspiration in what you're doing with Molly Must Die?
It was actually a very big part of a previous game that I was working on. I originally sort of started, it was probably at The World Ends With You that kind of really set off sort of looking at how that, you know, how that sort of very lo-fi visual communication, and yeah, I mean like lo-fi as in like technically not the quality of the art, but just how sort of effective that lo-fi communication can be. And then I sort of like started getting more and more into it and exploring it. And to the point where the game that we were previously on that we've sort of had to just push into the background for now, its whole dialogue engine was pretty much a straight out visual novel system. And I loved working in it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the thing that I find most interesting about visual novels is how kind of quickly they've come into the West. You know, they've been around in Japan for basically forever. But for the longest time, I don't think publishers, localizers, or anybody else really thought that there was much of a demand for it out here. So, you know, you have all these kind of classic visual novels that sat in Japan and never got looked at. But all of a sudden, I think when the digital distribution became a big thing and you didn't have to put everything in boxes to sell to people, people started to take a little bit more of a risk and they started to look at some of those visual novels that were quite successful. And I'm thinking about, you know, the kind of earlier pioneers of stuff like, you know, Steins Gate or Hakuoki is, the first Otome game that was actually localized into English originally. And you look at those games, kind of, they took a risk with them. The publishers took a risk with them and released them. And they discovered, hey, you know, people in the West aren't stupid. They do like, you know, stories with, you know, games that are story focused, or they like reading, or they like good characters. They like, you know, beautiful art and so on. And then all of a sudden, you know, you've got a whole bunch of localization outfits and they're starting to take the kind of the more niche stuff out of Japan and localize it as well. And that's great. I think it's, and like you said, Aussie to Matt, you're starting to see the storytelling techniques that are used in visual novels start to, you know, impact on how other developers look at their games, even if they're not visual novels themselves. And I think that's good too, because as far as I'm concerned, visual novels are kind of the premier storytelling genre by default, because that's all they do. So anything that encourages, or anything that's able to influence developers into weaving these kind of more complex stories in amongst the other stuff that they're doing is a good thing. I think it's good for the development of the industry.
The BioWare games are basically visual novels, but with a little bit of fighting thrown in there to appease people. But
yeah, especially the more recent ones. The earlier BioWare games, like the Baldur's Gate and whatever, brilliant game. I've got absolutely no issue with. I'm not going to ever criticize Baldur's Gate. I think it's one of the greatest games ever. But it's not really a visual novel. It is much more adventure, kind of exploration and combat focused. But when you get to stuff like Mass Effect, especially Mass Effect 3, I can't even remember individual levels. All I remember in Mass Effect 3 is my interactions with my characters and that final scene, which is, you know, a very narrative-driven scene. So, yeah, I agree with you. BioWare has... I don't think the developers of BioWare are actually thinking, hey, let's go make a visual novel, but hide it under, you know, shooty bro stuff. But I definitely think that the understanding that there is a demand for storytelling, actual storytelling in games, that we all saw as a result of the visual novels coming into the West definitely influenced how BioWare approaches its own storytelling.
It's really interesting that you, like you mentioned Mass Effect, because even off the back end of the new one, the Andromeda, I can't remember, like, I haven't played it yet. I have not seen a single person in any of my social media say, hey, that was a great gunfight I had. Like, it's all about, you know, their characters and their interactions and, you know, the possible squad mates and stuff like that. Which, yeah, it's a trend that, started, you know, far earlier in Mass Effect 3 was like some... it was like one long narrative sequence, sort of just punctuated by a bit of combat every once in a while.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the earlier Mass Effect 1 and to a certain extent Mass Effect 2 were much more gameplay orientated as well. For some reason, I don't remember the characters so well in Mass Effect 1. I do remember the specific situations where there was that scene where you had to choose between two squad mates. I kind of remember their names, but I remember there being a massive gunfight out of that scene. So yeah. I remember the gameplay in Mass Effect 1 to a much clearer degree than I remember the gameplay in Mass Effect 3. I agree, you're right. I think BioWare really learned how to do characters on the job with the Mass Effect series. And by the time they got to 3, they actually realized how to make, characters pretty cool. And at that point, it was all about Garrus and Tali. Garrus and Tali. And welcome back. So we talked a lot about narrative so far this week. Let's talk about the opposite thereof, pure action. We'll talk about the Warriors games for our last section this week. Both Matt and I were given copies of Dragon Quest Heroes 2 to play through. And I say this as somebody who is already a fan of Dragon Quest Heroes from the first one. The enhancements, the it has come along from its original is just absolutely incredible. This game is a genuine Game of the Year contender, as far as I'm concerned. It is pushing Warriors, the basic idea of Warriors, you know, lots of action and big hordes of enemies and killing lots of enemies and stuff like that. It's pushing it as far as you can possibly imagine, because you know, it actually feels like a genuine hybrid between RPG, JRPG, Dragon Quest style JRPG and Warriors game. And it's this really, really appealing mix. And if this is kind of an indication of where certain other Warriors games will be going, like Fire Emblem Heroes and Fire Emblem Warriors and you know, Warriors All-Star down the track and Dynasty Warriors 9, if it's kind of indication of where this series is going, I think the Warrior series, which has already been developing quite quickly in kind of the opinions of people, not many people just chalk them up as brainless button mashers anymore. But if that's where this franchise is going, Koei's onto something really massive into the near future, I feel.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you just said there. I haven't had a chance to play too much of it yet, but it seems like there's a lot more focus on not just on combat, so like exploration is a pretty big thing now, and like, I mean, this might seem like a little thing, but the fact that there are, you can be in combat or out of combat while you're running away, so mm-hmm. when there's enemies nearby, your character draws their swords and it's basically a Dynasty Warriors game with Dragon Quest, as the first game was. But then once you've killed all the enemies in the immediate vicinity, your character sheaths their sword, you can run, you can do a bit more exploration type stuff. And I mean, that's itself is quite a little thing, but I think it's symbolic of the game's general focus on being more of an, as Matt said, a hybrid between an RPG and a Warriors action game.
And looking at the material, like looking at the games now, you kind of can't, like Dynasty Warriors, like the old ones used to have this sort of very kind of specific look to how everything in that game played. Looking at Dragon Quest Heroes, it's like you kind of, the line is a lot more blurry there now.
I completely agree with you. And I mean, other things, you know, people used to have an issue with the earlier Dynasty Warriors having, you know, characters popping up like a couple of millimeters away from your character because the engine just wasn't able to handle that much movement on screen at once and stuff like that. And obviously, as technology's improved, that's kind of gone away. I think, you know, the last time I've had significant pop-up in a Warriors game was Warriors Orochi 3, which was basically a PlayStation 3 game rather than a PS4 one. The PS4, the Warriors games that have been developed specifically for PS4 don't have that issue, and you've got these gorgeous environments now. It's not, you know, purely functional graphics for the battle areas and stuff. You've got these lovely, colorful, vibrant environments. You've got characters that all fight significantly different to one another rather than just having, you know, a fairly standard approach to combat. And it's really good. It's not just it's not just Dragon Quest Heroes 2 that I'm talking about. You know, Hyrule Warriors on the Wii U was a really good Warriors game. Gorgeous game. You'd be hard pressed to think of a better looking Wii U game than that one. And even some of the licensed stuff like Arslan was a really good Warriors game because that's an anime and manga franchise that isn't really that well known in the West. And that game was kind of used to kind of introduce it. And it's a fairly complex kind of anime because it's based on medieval Persia, which not many people know about and not many people understand. And the game did an absolutely brilliant job of being a storytelling medium, and you know, people never used to think about Warriors games as storytelling. So this series just kind of goes from strength to strength, and it has so many different games and so many balls in the air now, but it seems to be nailing almost all of them, which is great.
And from a technical standpoint, like we were talking just before about like characters popping in very close to you in the older games, or sort of them sort of all fighting very similar or whatever. All these different aspects. Looking at the newer games, like they're still like, the older ones and newer ones, they've all been massive technical achievements in terms of having that much action on screen. It's not just about the quality of your graphics, but like AI pathfinding and stuff. All requires like very significant tricks to get working at that scale with that many people. It's just gone from strength to strength on that front as well.
Yeah, and I do love how Koei's never actually stopped working on being innovative with this series. Like, it's always annoyed me that people have chalked them up to being button mashers, because each one actually does try to push the whole kind of the Warriors formula forward. And, the next Dynasty Warriors, for example, is going to be open world. And that's going to be a massive change to the series. It's going to, it blows my mind to think about what they could possibly do with that, because open world Warriors is just, that could be the game that sells the kind of open world structures to me.
Breaks my brain thinking about the technical problems behind that must happen. Yeah. Oh,
wander over all of China. That's going to be amazing.
Nuts.
And that's what I love about the Warriors series. Koei really, this is obviously Koei's major franchise. It survives on this franchise. This is where its money comes from. And I can't think of too many other developer publishers that could exploit a franchise as much as Koei does with this one and still keep people interested and still manage to avoid becoming Me Too with every new game. Full props to them for that. Then obviously, I mean, I know the one that Ginny's most looking forward to, being another Warriors fan as well, is Warriors All-Stars, which is, the other great thing about Koei is because they've had so many Warriors games, they have such a massive cast to draw on. So if they want to do like a Smash Brothers style kind of mashup of every character that they've got, they did it with Warriors Orochi, but then they've got Warriors All-Star coming up, which also pulls in characters from Dead or Alive and Atelier and, Tsukunin and the other Koei franchises. Cool. And it's going to be this massive character mashup with, hundreds of characters, and it's going to be really good fun. Really looking forward to that one.
Yeah, and the best part, perhaps, for this upcoming Musou Stars game is the acclaimed soft engine. The soft engine is going to be in full force. Hey, that is a main selling point. Like, I don't know if you guys have watched the PVs that they've put out for Musou Stars, but all the PVs have like incredibly encouraging shots of the soft engine at work. I think this is one PV that's just all the Dead or Alive girls and Sophie from Atelier, and I'm just like, what is the point of this PV? And then everything's in slow motion. I'm like, I see what this PV is for. But I think the soft engine I think is really being marketed as a big selling point for Musou Stars. And honestly, why not? They deserve it. It is a great engine.
I mean, for people who don't know what the soft engine was, soft engine was developed by the Tecmo team at Koei Tecmo, and it was developed for Dead or Alive Extreme 3, which is the beach volleyball game where basically the entire experience is watching, pretty women jumping up and down and various bits and pieces off the girls' bodies moving with physics. So the whole point of that, the engine, is to make these, it's a character-based engine. It's an engine designed specifically to make characters look good. And we joke about it being, used for, bikini girls. But if you apply it to a game that's not just about that, like Musou or Warriors All-Star, what you have is a game that's all about the characters with an engine that's really showing off how good those characters can look. And you can have simple backgrounds and stuff after that, because people are just going to be focusing on their favorite character looking so good, beating up hundreds of enemies at once, and it's a visual masterpiece. Like, it's really, really gorgeous. And soft engine is what perhaps EA should invest in for the next Mass Effect, because they obviously need some help with the character model engines.
I don't know if that would be better or worse, like imagining the facial expressions from Mass Effect combined with more wobbling. I don't think that would help at all. I think I would just be more put off, actually.
But it's not just the wobbling I love of that engine. That engine is just so good at showing off skin. Like, it sounds stupid, but like the subtleties of lighting and the way that, you know, light moves over skin and the way that skin actually moves in, you know, in motion. There's a lot of science that goes into that, making that look good.
Yeah. Subsurface scattering, where it's basically light enters the model and is then sort of like splashed out underneath the skin to give an approximation of like what it looks like when light actually passes into the body.
And that's why we have a game developer on the podcast.
Yeah.
He can explain these things to us.
I'm really interested in how the soft engine, because like the term engine gets thrown around a lot without it necessarily meaning a whole lot. And I kind of really want to know sort of like just how much, and this is just like, you know, peak nerd curiosity, like this isn't relevant to anyone, but it's just, I really want to go and have a look at like all, like how much of this is like actually tech that you can dump in other games versus, you know, like how much of it is just like really clever rendering.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Koei's not obviously not going to tell us that, but yeah, it means the soft engine was obviously designed specifically for Koei to apply to its character-based games. And being a Japanese company, obviously these are all proprietary engines that the company develops for its own use, and then will discard eventually or iterate on once it decides to do something better. But I think that this engine, if you look at how Warriors All-Stars looks compared to the other Warriors games, you can definitely see an improvement in the kind of the beauty of the character models. They just look better. And I just, yeah, I can't think, I'm looking forward to them applying the same tech to Dynasty Warriors, you know, 9, which will have the biggest budget, I think, of the Warriors games, and they'll really push to make it kind of look AAA. Because I think that Koei, more than any other developer, and it's because of Dead or Alive, let's face it, but Koei, more than any other developer, knows how to make a good-looking character.
Amen.
And, you know, that's good for them. The Dynasty Warriors 9 is just going to be spectacular. I don't think anybody will be able to criticize that game. And it's due, apparently it's due for release this year, I think. So, you know, we talk about how the start of the year's been busy with game releases and stuff, and then the end of the year doesn't look too packed at the moment. Well, we haven't got a release date for Dynasty Warriors 9 as yet. That might be the big one.